RCR is on a mission to revive honest media. It's a good mission. And now you can be an integral part of it by joining the RCR Foundation Members Club. Receive exclusive benefits only available to club members, including discounted merch, your own backstage pass to join the hosts for interactive behind-the-scenes discussions, and the popular daily curated news summary, RCR Bites, delivered to your email box every weekday morning, keeping you on the pulse of the news that matters in just a few minutes per day. To find out more, check out www.realitycheck.radio/members or click the FMC button on the bottom right of your RCR app.
This is the Fourth Estate on RCR Reality Check Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Reality Check Radio and the Fourth Estate for this Friday, 7th of June. I'm your host today, Marie Buskey, and joining me is Professor Rob McCullough. He is the Matthew S. Abel Chair of Macroeconomics at Auckland University, as well as being the down-to-earth Kiwi blogger, which I understand you are thoroughly enjoing. Rob, great to have you on board with that. And you're going to unearth some of the meat and potatoes for us on the budget a little later on. And joining Rob is Dr. Muriel Newman. Of course, you know Muriel from the New Zealand Centre of Political Research, as well as being a Member of Parliament for 9 very long years, I'm sure, Muriel. And you know what? I've decided if they could knight people for services to common sense, you would have been Dame Muriel a long, long time ago. Welcome aboard, everybody.
Thank you very much for that.
You're most welcome. It's been a big old week. And obviously with the budget from last week, which we didn't really get a chance to fully digest in the Fourth Estate, but all the media has come out. And in true fashion, it's the classic too hard, too soft, just right. Rob, kick off, because this is very much in your wheelhouse. What were your observations in terms of the budget? What was reported? Do you feel it was a fair representation of what was there? And are Kiwis getting a pretty good handle of what's going on?
Well, I think where the mainstream media were somewhat unfair is not emphasising the state of the economy that the previous Labour government left things in. I mean, it's hard to imagine, especially the last 3 years of Labour, as being in any time in recent history a worse government. They really not just shattered the economy, but I think they shattered the confidence of New Zealanders. You know, Hipkins was COVID minister and was responsible for this lockdown at the end of 2021, this unending lockdown, which even though the majority of Aucklanders were vaccinated then, and that almost bankrupted the country. It went on indefinitely, and the cost of it in terms of these schemes like the wage subsidy was just monumental. You know, most people are sort of happy with how things were handled in 2020, but that lockdown at the end of 2021 was just disastrous. And it's emerged that together with Adrian Orr, Robertson and Orr together did one of the largest combined borrowing and printing money sprees in the world. And they've left a shattered country. And I think the budget has to be seen in that context. And the mainstream media, I don't think, really are laying that ground. So I think they have been unfair on that. I think the way to see the budget, to understand it, but also has not been well summarised. I think the best way to see it is that it's a classic National Party budget in the tradition of Bill English. It's almost as though Bill English wrote the budget. When the Nats got in 2008 with John Key, spending had been increasing, and Bill English and Key considered their main achievement to be a gradual decrease in the size of government spending and taxes. And this budget was not radical. It amounts to throwback to the Key Bill English years. It's not a sudden slashing. They're gradually decreasing drop taxes, not a large amount, but that's classic Bill English and dropping gradually government spending. So in that sense, it's what the Nats have always been. They've never been really radical. They're conservative, and their brand name is established on trying to be conservative, prudent managers of the country's finances. That's what the Nats have always been. So I see it in that tradition of a Bill English budget. I think the mainstream media were keen to link it to Ruth Richardson, which I think was outrageous. I think it's essentially a misogynist attack on Nicola Willis. Her budget has almost nothing to do with Ruth Richardson's budget. And Willis, in terms of her ideology, has very little to do, if anything, with Ruth Richardson. I think the attack line of the mainstream media was these descriptions of it as the mother of all disappointments. Willie Jackson characterized it as the mother of anti-Maori budgets. They wanted to link it to Ruth Richardson's mother of all budgets. They wanted to paint Willis as this she awful, she witch with a broomstick, this very unpleasant sort of mother who passed these horrible mother of budgets, and she's another sort of reincarnation of Ruth Richardson. I don't, Nicola Willis is the second woman finance minister in this country. Ruth was the first. I don't see why directly associating her with Ruth, who was in power 30 years ago, and whose budget did actually do some quite significant cuts to welfare. But Willis's budget was not a budget slashing the welfare state. The main cuts of the Nats have come from decreasing the number of civil servants in Wellington, who are actually quite highly paid, by the way. This is not very low income people on welfare. So I don't see the comparison with Ruth. It was very much a Bill English budget, but I think the mainstream media want to tie her to Ruth Richardson, that she's this kind of mean, horrible person who will take away people's welfare. And Ardern in recently in Bologna University, in she gave an address, and she also brought up the mother of all budgets of Ruth Richardson when she was talking to the Italians, and said she blamed it for the suicide of a neighbor of hers in Morrinsville. They seem obsessed with Ruth Richardson, and they want to tie this budget to Ruth's, but I don't see it has anything to do with Ruth. It's a Bill English budget.
No, yeah, agreed. Now, Muriel, is there something you brought up there in terms of what Willie Jackson said, the gaslighting in terms of this is an anti-Māori budget? Shane Te Pau expressed the same sentiments. Now, Muriel, you addressed that in your piece recently. That's far from the truth.
Well, that's right. I mean, I'd heard all of this rhetoric about, there's nothing in it for Maori. So I just thought, well, let's have a look. There's heaps still in there for Maori. I mean, it goes over the top to continue on many of the programs that Labor put in place. I mean, just one easy thing to remember is that the Ministry of Maori Development got almost $500 million in specialist funding for Maori programs. And these are programs for things like Maori wellbeing, Maori housing. It covers all these different sort of areas of society for Maori. And obviously, there's nothing equivalent for anyone else who's in need. And so, yeah, the rhetoric about how anti-Maori the budget is just complete and utter nonsense. And I think Rob put it very well in that, this was a Bill English style budget. I mean, obviously it had two sort of elements to it. One was the tax relief from the reduction of wasteful spending. And then the second one was the borrowing to repair frontline services. And there was a balance that they were trying to create. And on top of that, obviously, they're trying to redirect the country into growth. And so they want to essentially change the culture. And, you have to say, good luck in changing the culture of the public service. But what occurred to me was that, Labor took, what, 5 years, 4 years to make the mess that the country is in. And again, as Rob said, I don't think the media did the country justice in that they tried to gloss over how bad the situation was for this country, how bad Labor, the mess that Labor had created. But it only took them a few short years to get us into the hole. But man, to get us out of it, it's probably going to take 10 years. And again, this is the sort of philosophy of Bill English, and we saw it during the global financial crisis. It was steady as she goes. They wanted to do it in a quiet, sort of incremental way rather than, a faster return to surplus and all the rest of it, which requires more pain in the process. And, so gradually, what is it? The Labor got government spending to almost 35% of the economy. And, Nicola Willis wants to get it down below 30%. It was 27% when Labor took over. And, when you go back to Bill English's days, I mean, his goal was always to get government spending down to 25% of the economy, which leaves plenty of room for the private sector wealth creators to generate the prosperity that New Zealand needs if we're going to get those high living standards to which we all aspire. You have to shrink the state and you have to allow the freedom for the private sector to do its job and generate wealth, jobs, prosperity for everyone. And so Nicola is on that path, but incrementally. And when you look at debt, it was 17% just over when Labor got into government. It's blown out. It's going to reach 43% of GDP. And they're trying to get it down to between 20 and 40%, but again, it's incremental. And so they've taken a slow path to try and heal the wounds that Labor created and presumably not do too much more damage in the process. But they are reducing government spending. They are giving tax cuts. Inflation is coming down. They are expecting to see growth. So it will take us in the right direction, but a lot more slowly than some people were hoping for.
So, well, I mean, it's that old adage, isn't it? It's a marathon, not a sprint, Muriel. And I think Nicola Willis has taken that spirit in the budget. The one glaring hole that several commentators picked up, I mean, obviously the Māori commentators are going to beat their drum, but was the coalition promise around the cancer drugs, the 13 cancer drugs, not being in this budget? And of course, the one thing, if you've got a terminal illness that you don't have the luxury of, is time. So, if there was going to be any sprinting required, it would have been in that space. Why do you think that was an omission in this particular budget and with a potential deferral for later on?
Well,
Anything?
I think it was inexplicable.
Yeah.
It was they could have found the money. There's so much money splashed around in budgets. They could have found it. I understand it's something to do with it's not a simple thing to allocate money for specific drugs, but other governments have done it over the years. Yes, it was just one of those things that you look at it and you just scratch your head and say, why?
What are your thoughts on that, Rob? Do you see that as a form of false economics, and this particularly something that, from a media perspective, is such a hot potato that will tarnish any good work that you've already done and laid out in the budget?
Yes, I concur with Muriel. It's in many ways I'm not going to defend it at all, because Willis and the Nats made a big thing that these cancer drugs were not funded. And what were they implying in those critiques? That people were potentially dying, and those deaths were on the head of Robertson and the health minister. It's quite a strong thing to do to say, look, they're so mean, they can't find money for that. And, so it's a very, very strong allegation. And then to come into power and then not find the funding, my guess is it was just a mistake. They just didn't notice it. And it somehow got missed out. But it exposes a bigger crack in the Nats. I mean, I try to be nonpartisan in my comments. I'm not here to attack Labor. And as for the Nats, look, this approach I remember of spending wisely has, although that's what they're meant to stand for in economics, the way to do that, we have a method, cost-benefit analysis. And in the coalition agreement, they swore by cost-benefit analysis. It said, in budgetary decisions, fiscal decisions, regulatory decisions, we will weigh up, we will subject them to rigorous cost-benefit analysis. Now, Pharmac does these kinds of cost-benefit analyses. And, should it emerge that there are a dozen people who may die over the next 6 months because they couldn't get the drugs they wanted, that's a terrible cost. And, may if to the extent that outweighs the relatively smaller amount of money to purchase the drugs they need, it would be a gross violation of cost-benefit analysis. And they're continuing with things like the movie subsidies and a whole bunch of corporate welfare. So are they pre prepared, as Willis prepared, to take the stand and say, I think giving the world's richest man, Jeff Bezos, and Amazon some more movie subsidies so they don't leave Wellington, where, by the way, she stood for election, and I put that ahead of these cancer sufferers. That's a terrible, terrible, thing to say, and it violates every principle that I thought they stood by. And what she's come undone by is that we have to ask, is this a government of principles? Is this just the old Nats who are doing what Bill English always did, just trim here a bit, play this game that we're the conservative people, try to marginalize ACT a bit and say they're a bit radical. We're the natural party of government. Are they just playing these national party games, and they're not actually subjecting themselves to any set of principles, principle decision making? And I think that's a potential crack in the budget. Are these cuts, have they been thought through? Are they just willy-nilly cuts across the board? And actually, you're harming some extremely worthy causes. Maybe this has caught them out.
I mean, it's in a way they've almost forgotten the golden rule, the one thing they could have learned from Jacinda Ardern, and that is watch the optics, because that is something that she was always first and foremost. And the optics on this have just been, I mean, that's been the face plant for me, for Willis, on this budget, but also to the fact, and I think you brought it up with cost-benefit analysis, Rob, that healthcare is, as far as I'm concerned, core service. Funding movie subsidies is not core service. So they, in a way, have forgot the absolute foundational basics of what governance should be. What are your thoughts around that, Muriel? I mean, are they, have there been some areas that she could have trimmed more heartily to fund things like there's been good money going to infrastructure and the like to find this money for core services, but have been more frivolous and they potentially kept because they don't want to upset some very influential, powerful people?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. I think that they probably went through the list of funding, programs that were being funded, and said, well, can we remove this one without too much fuss? Tick. And can we remove this one without too much fuss? Oh no, that's going to create a lot of trouble. So we'll keep that one in there. And so yes, principle I think sort of was secondary in all of this. And look, your comment about, watching the optics, I mean, that's exactly right. And that's where Jacinda was an expert. Just on compassionate grounds, for goodness sake. They should have looked at all the budget promises. Have we done as many as we can, as many as feasible? The cancer one would have actually stood out because, as you said, it was attacking, the politicians. And so, you've got to be held accountable for such promises. And, why on earth wasn't it picked up? It's just a big flaw from my point of view. But look, going back to cutting spending, it's a dreadful fact that the public service increased by 20,000 people between 2017 and, this last election. And, when you think about all those people, and of course many were probably hired on the basis of their Labor's social justice agenda. So it wasn't on the basis of, are you the best person for the job? It was, do you fulfill these criteria? And, so you have to say that the actual performance of many of those recent hires is possibly not as good as it should be. And you have to think, well, they should be removing the sort of excessive number of people and removing the wasteful programs that they represent. That should be really high on their agenda. They have said that, by the way. They have said that they're going to continue to, reduce numbers and reduce wasteful spending and, stop programs and all the rest of it. But you just worry that it's words, and that once they get going, as Rob has said, it'll just be business as usual, let's get on. And we'll be left with a public service which is far too big for the size of the country, far too interfering in everyone's lives and far too costly. And it'll actually hamper our ability to get back to being the sort of go-ahead country that we could be.
I really would dearly love to know whether Waka Kotahi has trimmed down their PR staff, because I think at one point they had about 120 on the media team, which, I found astonishing for a roading network. But there you go.
You said that, by the way, the optics were good. You see, I'm against governing a country on the optics. I'm against that. That is what Ardern represented. And as Muriel said, they probably just went through all these things, didn't apply any objectivity on thinking they were trying to get the optics right. Then the optics turned out awful. This is what happens. You know, if you live by the sword, you die by the sword. So they did the budget on optics. Then this looked awful with the cancer thing. And then how does Willis respond? I think it was, in a way, an awful abrogation of this idea of principles, that she's obviously panicked and obviously going to reverse this decision in the next 6 months. Well, what's she doing? She's governing like Ardern on the optics. She's got bad headlines. Mm. It looks awful. She's run off because the optics look awful, and that's not a way to govern. That's my view. She should have applied principles in the first place.
Well, the interesting thing is Thomas Coughlin actually touched on this on the Weekend Herald, and it was the Taxpayer Union snap poll that was done immediately after the budget. It found 8% of voters thought the budget was very good, followed by 20% who thought it was good, and a further 48% that thought it was okay. Well, I think for me that puts it square in the Goldilocks zone. There were, again, a further 17% of voters thought it was bad, and 7% thought it was very bad. And I mentioned with Marty the other day on Counterculture that I found it really interesting the mirroring at the extremes of that survey at 8% thinking very good, with 7% thinking very bad. Very close number. The poll was a sharp, was 500 responses, 4% margin of error. It showed that 22% of voters thought spending in the budget was too high, while 21% of the voters thought the spending was too low. Again, that mirroring. So it sort of, from that, just that snapshot immediately after, the public perception is that she pretty much had it about right, which is interesting but it's those on the fringes. It's the 7 and 8%, the 21 and 22% that make the noise, I think, if they can get an opportunity in the media to sway opinion one way or another. But I was actually quite heartened to see that.
Maybe getting onto a truth that Muriel alluded to. The budget doesn't seem to me this country's problem. The budget, although it's a big media event and a big hype, the problem is it seems over the last 6 years or so, meritocracy has disappeared in this country. People are getting jobs they don't deserve based on other characteristics not related to their marks. I know this from the students. It's not connected with how well they've done. In fact, to the extent they've done very well, and people think it's a result of privilege, they're being targeted for being counted out of jobs. So, when you desert meritocracy and when the rules and incentives of this country have all been based around fulfilling equity but not efficiency. That's how economists divide up the world. Some policies enhance efficiency, others equity. The country seems to me to be fully on this line. The only thing that matters is equity. It's abandoned meritocracy, it's abandoned efficiency and productivity. Now, I think it's the rules. It's not how much money is being thrown around here or there and some sort of trimming of the spending or whatever. I think it's the rules and the incentive system of this country that has become deeply undermined. And I think that's why talented Kiwis are leaving, and the future of the country is very uncertain. It's not about the budget.
Any final thoughts on
Look,
that, Neil?
I agree with, I totally agree with what Rob has said. And one of the figures that sort of has been bandied around recently was the terrible decline in productivity in this country. And, you sort of sit there and you think, well, why, New Zealanders work harder than many people in many countries. So it's not about the amount of or hours that we work. It's to do with how much stuff we produce per hour that we work. And you think to yourself, well, in this age of increasing technology, why is it that people are producing less? And the answer has to be to do with the absolute mountain of regulations that have been poured onto the country over the last 6 years. It was always bad, don't get me wrong. I mean, other governments have said we're going to, get rid of red tape and regulate unnecessary regulation, and then they do a little bit, they dabble, and they leave mountains of stuff there that we could go through and axe. But under Labor, it just got so much worse, and a lot of it was to do with their social justice agenda. This business of putting equity and ethnicity and all these things ahead of who's the best for the job and what's the best thing we can do to achieve these goals. And and so the idea of success and excellence, it's all been dragged down because obviously if you aspire to those things, again, as Rob said, you must be privileged or you must be greedy or something. Well, that's no way to encourage a country to do well. We've got to change that, and we've got to get rid of all vestiges of this stuff that Labor put in there, all the regulations around that, all this blinking, huge departments dealing with, I don't know, climate change or dealing with equity and diversity and inclusion. There's just so much stuff that's been, added on to the private and public sectors. That just needs to disappear, and then people can get on with doing a good job, doing better, striving for success. That's the way you build a nation.
So when the incentives are wrong, which National so far hasn't corrected, but secondly, the main budgetary problem is caused by the aging population, which is going to blow out the healthcare budget. And the budget is doing nothing to address the issues of the aging population. So when you combine aging population, the rules are wrong, the budget is just actually tinkering.
Yeah, and the other look, you're both heading into my counterculture territory. And as much as I'm deeply tempted to go down that pathway, I know my producer will have a flea in my ear because this is the Fourth Estate. But it's interesting that you do say that because, particularly with the demographics as well, aging population, which actually has peaked, and but then of course, how do you then prepare infrastructure, for example, things like education and healthcare for a steeply declining birth rate. You put all this work into training teachers, and I know that the education policy placed out by Erica Stanford ahead of the budget had actually some really good wins in there. She got actually ticks and endorsements, tentatively perhaps in some places, by actually key organisations and even unions. That, yes, this is a step in the right direction. But then what happens when the demographics 30 years from now, or even 20 years from now, when or even less than that, I mean, I think what's New Zealand's birth rate down to now? About 1.51, I think, or 1.54. It was 1.8 prior to the pandemic, births, live births per adult human female. And it's and that is a concern, because if you're creating more teachers, creating more schools and opening up more spaces, but in less than 5 years, you're going to have a lot less kids coming through at the bottom end. That in itself is creating a problem. But we could, oh, I'm just aware of time, and I think we do need to move on. Because the other juxtaposition that you're talking about, I do like the idea of this meritocracy direction. And one of the places that we saw this in the media really clearly exposed has been the tale of two medias, which has been the tale between linear television and the profitability, therefore, and the success and the continued growth and stability of broadcast radio. And TVNZ have had a couple of hits in this last week. The first being they have lost the employment appeal with the ERA around the redundancies that they're wanting to announce, particularly around Sunday and Fair Go. So I can certainly see that's going to be a very expensive legal and settlement process for them in the future. And then the other element has been in terms of the downgrading of their profit forecast. And it's not just a small downgrade, Rob. It's quite a significant downgrade. They are looking at almost doubling it, I understand, from 15 million down to $28 million. I mean, that's huge. Yeah, citing primarily the drop in advertising for linear television, even though they've picked a little bit up digitally. And then juxtaposed. Oh, and you look across to what's been going on in radio, and in radio, you're having now more people listening to radio than it's ever been, and commercial radio. So that doesn't include stations like us, but commercial radio, 73% of New Zealanders are listening to this on any given day, and they are now seeing great successes. So, in terms of where you look at the two mediums, it's funny, where do you think the future, just for your thoughts, because you both undertake your own independent forms of media in one form or the other, whether it be blogging or your own sites, where do you see this balance between both television and radio going, say, over the next 5 years? Start with you, Rob.
Well, I think TVNZ should be wound up. It's probably not worth anything, and I think it should just go. I think it serves no purpose whatsoever. The whole thing should just go. No one's interested in it. The only purpose of a state-owned broadcaster is if it gives something which all the other broadcasters don't give, which comes in the form of not being biased and striving to give both sides of a debate. The Public Broadcasting Service in the US is the most trusted service there. In Sweden, the most trusted news service is a state-owned broadcaster. TVNZ is extremely biased. It gives one-sided views that are just outrageous on most issues. If you want a biased new broadcaster, well, you've got Fox News, you've got 1,000 million outlets in the world that'll give you a biased view. So, because TVNZ went this way of being biased, they perform no social service whatsoever. Well, and they're loss-making, so what's the point of them? You may be prepared to subsidize them if they were giving something, an unbiased view. But I just wish they'd disappear.
So, would you think then you'd be wanting to put all that funding in the RNZ basket as Willie Jackson did to the tune of $25 million last year or the year before?
Well, again, the acid test is, are they going to be an unbiased broadcaster? It's no sense having any state-owned broadcaster if they're going to present these one-sided views of so to the extent that all depends on how well Radio New Zealand are doing their job in terms of being balanced. But if they're not going to be balanced, then good luck to them. They should go also. I don't see the point in the taxpayer having to fund a biased news outlet. The whole point of government-owned broadcasters, the BBC has been under massive attack in Britain for being biased, and they're trying to address that bias. They actually are, quite seriously. So I don't see any addressing of it here, and I think we've all had a guts full of it, and I wish they'd just go away.
Yeah, Muriel, what do you think?
Oh, look, I
I hear
agree.
chuckling,
Totally
Muriel.
agree.
I hear chuckling.
God, it's just terrible. I mean, you turn on the 6 o'clock news on television, and at the end of it, your blood pressure's gone up. You've yelled at the TV. It's just ridiculous. And you thought to yourself that once the election came along, they would start to improve. Well, they've got worse. Do you know that there's a clip going around on social media looking at the response from the budget in 2021, where certain people in society got $20 a week from the tax reductions or subsidies or whatever it was. Anyway, they were getting $20 a week extra. And of course, in this budget with the tax cuts, some people would be getting $20 a week as well. And back in 2021, when they interviewed the recipients of the $20 a week, it was like, oh man, this is so wonderful. It's life changing. And the things I'll be able to do, it's fantastic. And then this time around, the $20 a week, oh, it's nothing. What are they thinking? They shouldn't have even bothered. The difference was chalk and cheese. It was so graphic. And we all remember that, right? We all remember how, when Labor was in government, there was almost no criticism of what they were doing, even though the health waiting lists were growing. There was never a program about how bad things had got. It was just all soft soaping, their sort of agenda and supporting them. And of course, with National being in government, it's been the exact opposite. There is nothing on TV, hardly, that actually says they're doing good here and there and, wherever. It's all negative. There's no balance at all. It is shocking. And so, yes, I totally agree with Rob. And, if I was the government, I wouldn't be putting any advertising money into Television New Zealand. They don't deserve it. Put the money where, people get balance. And as you've said, commercial radio is doing that, and good on them. They're doing a fantastic job.
Well, I think Steve
As
Mahoney.
is other programs like yourselves, by the way. You're in a different category, but it's been wonderful to see the rise of alternative media. And man alive, did the country need it when you arrived? And it's fantastic that you're still going so strongly.
Oh, thank you, Muriel. And it's good to be able to get back on air as well. I mean, there was a bit of a speed wobble there. But I was actually saying to Rob before we got started, in terms of what we are able to do on the smell of an oily rag and then the donations that we receive, I think we punch well above our weight. And just sort of 2 points, Steve Mahari talked about in his column on the weekend over the budget that after 150 days, this government appears to be waning in the popularity of the people. But unlike the previous government, in their first 150 days as a fully majority first past the post style government, who got the softest of soft landings and were almost adulated within our media. Poor old Christopher Luxon, David Seymour, and Winston Peters have barely even drawn the most smallest modicum of a break from the media. There's been no honeymoon period, no soft landing, no nothing. It has been attack, 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 attack from the minute that they arrived. So I think you're very right, Muriel, in the sense that it's very, very difficult for them to get on the business of governing when they're sort of in a way the media is acting as a fourth political ally on the left. I think that's my opinion for what it's worth.
Yeah, and I think that we shouldn't forget that, a couple of years ago, the World of Journalism study that was published by Massey University provided us with the views of journalists themselves. So there were 1,600 journalists I think, who'd been invited to take part in this survey, and they were asked where they sit on the political spectrum. And it was overwhelmingly left-wing and very strongly left-wing. They said, you know, they're very radical left-wingers. And you think to yourself, well, it's always been like that, right? The media, we've always known that. But in previous times, the newsrooms have said we have to have balance. And that's been the key difference over recent years. It seems that that sort of journalist ethic of providing balanced news to, you know, your audiences, the fourth estate, that's what the fourth estate is all about, holding government to account, but in a balanced way, that seems to have fallen by the wayside. And now their key purpose appears to be to indoctrinate the public and change their mind and put forward their own political views rather than presenting the news and allowing people to make up their mind. So I think a lot of it is to do with how the newsrooms are operating themselves, and I think their boards need to, you know, have a really strong look at what it is that their news media are producing, and just do that simple process of saying, are we giving balance? And if the answer is no, you're going to go down that slippery slide because the public won't put up with it. We do to a certain extent, but in the end, it just gets us, and we say, no, blow them. We're going to go and look for something better.
Yeah, well, I think that survey you referred to, it was something like 81 or 82% considered themselves left. So it's a significant number. And you also mentioned too about those newsrooms. Like, I know that I was one of the last people trained in the old system from the New Zealand broadcasting days. And that was where you went into a community station and you basically learned on the job in a cadetship type style arrangement. And I was one of the very, very last, if not the last, that went through that sort of system. I know the girl that replaced me in a broadcasting in the broadcasting space. I moved to another role in the company, was Amanda Gillies, and she was fresh out of broadcasting school. So that was the big shift. Now, Rod, coming from the tertiary sector, do you think that that has also been one of the issues with the Fourth Estate? All of these young journalists that are moving through the system now, unlike the likes of Barry Soper et al., who have trained on the job under editors, they've learned all those fundamentals of what it meant to be in the Fourth Estate. We now have newsrooms full of young graduates, idealistic young graduates who then bring their political flavour to the mix.
Oh, undoubtedly. If you mean brainwashed, I would agree with you. Yes, and it's even worse than that because you've been mentioning the Fourth Estate, but we seem to be sensing that there is a tectonic shift in the country. It seems that the Fourth Estate does not regard this government from day one as legitimate. It doesn't seem to take the view they deserve to be there, and they're making life as difficult for it as they can. And it seems to me, you mentioned universities, but if you look at the forces that have aligned against this new coalition, you have the mainstream media. But why are they quite smug and cocky about taking on the government? I think it's because they think they've got the courts on their side, that many of the things the government want to do, they're having problems because of what's looked like a biased judiciary. And when you add to that the universities as well, you're getting hugely powerful organizations. The students, the schools, the universities, the judiciary, the media, and they're looking at, you know, who are these people, sort of Winston, Seymour, Luxon, who do they think they are? I mean, we're much more powerful than them, and we're going to take them on and beat them. And my view is that is somewhat what's going on. The trivial detail that over half the country voted for National ACT and NZ First doesn't seem to matter much to them.
No, and a lot of these things are reflected out, I think, in these awards as well. So, I mean, in the commercial survey that was out the other week, the head of the Heap again, has been Newstalk ZB. And significantly, when you're looking at total share, percentage share, they're the only station that's in double figures at 14%. And then all the other music stations fall in behind them. Now, to be fair, Radio New Zealand doesn't fit into the survey because it's not commercial. But still, that is the flagship from that perspective. And then when you look at the radio and podcast awards that went out last night, which I do like to call the participation awards because it is, there was, I mean, I am surprised they did not have a category for best station pet, but they pretty much had a category for everything else. But again, talk show and producing team, Mike Hosking Breakfast, won that again. Now, one of the things that stood out for me, like absolute, using continuing the metaphor with animals, dog balls, is the Mike Hosking Breakfast has a producing team of three people for that show. And if you've ever listened to it, it's tight, it's good, it's well done. And the production team, I think, praise where praise is due, do a very good job. Also nominated in the finals were Heather Duplessis, Alan Drive, Marcus Last Nights, and Morning Report. By contrast, Morning Report with RNZ has 17 producers, 17 to produce the same minutes and content as Mike Hosking Breakfast. Now, the glaring difference between the two of those, one is commercial, one is not. No prizes, it keeps guessing which is which, really, on those numbers. But there was no, the only other thing that stood out for me, and I just wondered whether you wanted to comment on this, Muriel, is they have dived into podcasts now. NZME are very much leading the way in this space, along with the New Zealand, well, both with the New Zealand Herald and Newstalk ZB. With podcasts, and they are heading very much down in that direction. The one glaring, gaping hole in all the awards handed out to podcasts, not even nominated but within the finals, was Leighton Smith, which I understand, if not, is the number one podcast for NZME. It's certainly in that top echelon. I was stunned. And as someone who's a frequent flyer with Leighton, I bet you were pretty surprised by that as well.
Yeah, he's done a sterling job, and times when you really start to lose your faith in humanity when you listen to the media all around you and it's all negative and nasty and vindictive and all the rest of it, and then you listen to Leighton, he does restore faith and makes you sort of realize that there will be light at the end of the tunnel. And obviously Newstalk ZB and all the rest of it. So yes, that was a surprise. He does a wonderful job. It's long form journalism, and so it's not everyone's cup of tea because people like the quick sound bites these days, it seems. But no, he is fantastic, and it was a surprise.
One of the things, yeah, and I fully agree. I have to admit, I'd listen to Leighton purely because I think to myself, how can I become a better broadcaster? And he is the template that I certainly use when it comes to this job, that's for sure. I want to sort of now segue across to some gaping holes that appeared in this last week in the media. After the budget and just prior to the budget, Te Pāti Māori released an advertisement via another organisation, which was seemed to be, I don't know whether they were headed, but from an optics point of view, by Rāwiri Waititi's wife, John Tamihere's daughter, and that was doing the rounds in social media and independent media quite heavily, and they were calling for this day of activation on Budget Day. So they'd obviously had a crystal ball in Te Pāti Māori that they must have known what was going to be coming because they were already aggrieved by it before it was announced. So they called this day of activation and they pulled back the imagery of the two guns and they placed that out there. And then, of course, since then, this so-called day of activation, there has been whistleblowers that have come forward in terms of impropriety around funding with the Manurewa Marae and with a lot of roads leading back to the Waipiraita Trust. I know that Andrea Vance put out a piece in the Sun, in the Post, I think it was, and then it was also rerun in the Sunday Star Times, She'd obviously been working on that for a while, talking to these whistleblowers, and just essentially painting a web of interconnectivity of the complexities of Māori funding from the government for Māori services and the overlaps between services such as collecting data for census, such as applying services for COVID, and what happens to that data and how it is used. Very good piece. Outside of Newstalk ZB, crickets. And it's quite a, from a political perspective, I would have thought that this would be the lead story in every single mainstream media format the last week. Nothing. Thoughts on that, Rob?
I'll defer to Muriel.
Fair enough. Muriel, what are your
Yeah.
thoughts around that? Because I know you've done a lot of work in this space.
Yeah, there's two issues really. We must not forget the impact that the Public Interest Journalism Fund has had on the way newsrooms report Māori issues. Now, if you remember, when that came out, it was, what was it, over $50 million, and stations could, or media organisations could apply for funding. One of the things they had to do was they had to promote the treaty partnership agenda that Labor was pushing. That was the basis of that Hipūpua blueprint to, you know, transform New Zealand from a democratic society to one tribal rule society by 2040, which is the 200th anniversary of the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi. And that got a lot of traction under Labor. And part of it was that if you accepted the funding, then you had to promote the treaty partnership, which is a fiction, by the way. There was no flipping treaty partnership. But anyway, and if you didn't promote Maori issues in a positive light, you were threatened with having to pay back the funding. Now, the Public Interest Journalism Fund, although the applications for new funding stopped in 20, they stopped last year, the thing still runs on till 2026. Now, they might have actually axed it in the budget, but I wasn't able to find any reference to it, so it probably still applies. And so you've probably got a lot of newsrooms out there who just now have got all these protocols in place where, you know, no matter what we see or do not criticise Māori because we might lose our funding or have to pay it back. And so we mustn't forget that that overlay is still there. And remember, to get the money, they had to show in their, you know, like their statements of intent and all these things, they had to show how they were going to be pro-Maori in the future and reflect a Maori worldview. So it wasn't just a simple matter of taking the money and running a couple of new journalists who had a sort of a, you know, a Maori lens on them. It was actually changing the structure of the organisations. And so to unravel that is going to take some time. And as I say, some of this money is probably still going to be going to them for another flipping 18 months to 2 years. I mean, it's quite outrageous. So I think that's the first thing. And but, you know, secondly, the whole mess of the Waipori, that Andrea Vance, and again, you have to give her a medal for what she's done, that she's exposed. There's a one basic thing that comes into this, and this is Whānau Ora. Now, Whānau Ora was given $182 million in this latest budget. And the thing that most people don't understand is that from what I believe, it's not a Crown entity, which means the audit department cannot audit them. They specifically had a battle when the thing was being set up. I remember it was under Tariana Turia and the Māori Party back in the day when they were coalition partners with National. I think I'm right on that. And they did not want anyone to interfere with how they use the money. And so what happens is that the $182 million of taxpayers' money gets handed over to, I think there's three commissioning agents. I understand John Tamaheri is the chief executive of the of Whānau Ora, and he was one of the commissioning agents. I'm not sure if that's changed or not, but then they hand that money over to the likes of the Waipariri Trust and all these different organisations, and the audit department cannot look into it to see, you know, how well is the money being spent. And so now we've got Andrea Vance telling us that, you know, during the election campaign, we had the Waipariri or the Marae at the centre of the allegations, you know, handing out supermarket vouchers for $100 and all sorts of things once you'd completed your voting forms. And, you know, you've got all this stuff going on, which is to do with, you know, potentially treating, which is against the law, versus hospitality, which Marae do. But ultimately, the funding is probably can all be traced back to Whānau Ora and the taxpayer, and yet there's no or means for government officials to audit that trail as a matter of, you know, normal business. And that's wrong. That is really wrong. So I know there's many, many different inquiries going on now from Stats New Zealand, Ministry of Social Development, Charities Commission, you know, there's loads of different Privacy Commissioner, there's loads of different inquiries, but I think one of them has got to look into this whole funding stream through Whānau Ora. It is just wrong that an organisation that gets so much taxpayer money is not subjected to the same financial disciplines as every other organisation in New Zealand that gets taxpayers' money.
Well, I mean, to that, Muriel, and you're right. Yeah, that's, and it's a huge amount of money, an absolute huge amount of money. Look, we're coming up on time. I'm going to have to wrap this up, but I have to say, yeah, big ups on Andrea Vance for that story. I just hope some more journalists now will take her lead and actually start doing their jobs and looking into this. Mike McRoberts, actually, I think you're moving over to NPR looking at Māori business. There you go, Mike. There's a story for you. Why don't you dive into this and see what's actually there? I think that would be a really good place to start. And of course, we will do this all again with the Fourth Estate next week. I want to thank you, my guest this morning, Professor Rob McCullough. How are you? Thank you very much, Rob, for your insights this
Thank you.
morning, especially around the budget. And Dr. Muriel Newman, thank you this morning for joining us. And of course, don't disappear. Dewa Du Bois is here next with the dialogue with more on the story around Te Pāti Māori, where he talks to Haimona Gray, PR relations consultant who has insider knowledge on John Tamaheri, president of Te Pāti Māori, and the dark side of his fiefdom, coming up next with Reality Check Radio.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you. So connect with us today.